Vacation starts with VA. Whether you're feeling beachy, mountainy, or every-y in between, you'll find all that you love all in one trip to Virginia. Start yours at virginia.org.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Introduction to Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Introduction. Dame History is so austere a lady that if one has been so ill-advised as to take a liberty with her, one should hasten to make amends by repentance and confession. Events have been transposed to the extent of some few months in this narrative, in order to preserve the continuity and evenness of the story. I hope so small a divergence may seem a venial error after so many centuries. For the rest, it is as accurate as a good deal of research and hard work could make it. The matter of diction is always a question of taste and discretion in a historical reproduction. In the year 1350, the upper classes still spoke Norman French, though they were just beginning to condescend to English. The lower classes spoke the English of the original Piers Plowman text, which would be considerably more obscure than their superiors' French if the two were now reproduced or imitated. The most which the chronicles can do is to catch the cadence and style of their talk, and to infuse here and there such a dash of the archaic as may indicate their fashion of speech. I am aware that there are incidents which may strike the modern reader as brutal and repellent. It is useless, however, to draw the 20th century and label it the 14th. It was a sterner age, and men's code of morality, especially in matters of cruelty, was very different. There is no incident in the text for which very good warrant has not been given. The fantastic graces of chivalry lay upon the surface of life, but beneath it was a half-savage population, fierce and animal, with little ruth or mercy. It was a rude, raw England, full of elemental passions, and redeemed only by elemental virtues. Such I have tried to draw it. For good or bad, many books have gone to the building of this one. I look round my study table, and I survey those which lie with me at the moment, before I happily disperse them for ever. I see Lacroix's Middle Ages, Erman's Art of War, Rietstap's Armorial General, de la Borderie's Historie Bretagne, Dame Berner's Book of St. Albans, the Chronicle of Jocelyn of Brookland, The Old Road, Hewitt's Ancient Armour, Cousin's Heraldry, Boutel's Arms, Brown's Chaucer's England, Cust's Scenes of the Middle Ages, Husseren's Wayfaring Life, Ward's Canterbury Pilgrims, Cornish's Chivalry, Hastings's British Archer, Strutt's Sports, John's Froissant Hargrove's Archery, Longman's Edward III, and Wright's Domestic Manners. With these and many others, I have lived for months. If I have been unable to combine and transfer their effect, the fault is mine. Arthur Conan Doyle, Undershaw, November 30, 1905. End of introduction. Chapter 1 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 1. The House of Loring. In the month of July of the year 1348, between the feasts of St. Benedict and of St. Swithin, a strange thing came upon England, for out of the east there drifted a monstrous cloud, purple and piled, heavy with evil, climbing slowly up the hushed heaven. In the shadow of that strange cloud, the leaves drooped in the trees, the birds ceased their calling, and the cattle and the sheep gathered, cowering under the hedges. A gloom fell upon all the land, and men stood with their eyes upon the strange cloud, and a heaviness upon their hearts. They crept into the churches, where the trembling people were blessed and shriven by the trembling priests. Outside, no bird flew, and there came no rustling from the woods, nor any of the homely sounds of nature. All was still, and nothing moved save only the great cloud, which rolled up and onward, with fold on fold from the black horizon. To the west was the light summer sky, to the east this brooding cloud bank, creeping ever slowly across, until the last thin blue gleam faded away, and the whole vast sweep of the heavens was one great leaden arch. Then the rain began to fall. All day it rained, and all the night, and all the week, and all the month, until folk had forgotten the blue heavens and the gleam of the sunshine. It was not heavy, but it was steady and cold and unceasing, so that the people were weary of its hissing and its splashing, with a slow drip from the eaves. Always the same thick, evil cloud flowed from east to west, and with the rain beneath it. None could see for more than a bowshot from their dwellings for the drifting veil of the rainstorms. Every morning the folk looked upward for a break, but their eyes rested always upon the same endless cloud, until at last they ceased to look up, and their hearts despaired of ever seeing a change. It was raining at Lammastide, and raining at the Feast of the Assumption, and still raining at Michaelmas. The crops and the hay, sodden and black, had rotted in the fields, for they were not worth the garnering. The sheep had died, and the calves also, so there was little to kill when Martinmas came, and it was time to salt the meat for the winter. They feared a famine, but it was worse than famine which was in store for them. For the rain had ceased at last, and a sickly autumn sun shone upon a land which was soaked and sodden with water. Wet and rotten leaves reeked and festered under the foul haze which rose from the woods. The fields were spotted with monstrous fungi of a size and colour never matched before, scarlet and mauve and liver and black. It was as though the sick earth had burst forth into foul pustules. Mildew and lichen mottled the walls, and with that filthy crop death sprang also from the water-soaked earth. Men died, and women and children. The baron of the castle, the franklin of the farm, the monk in the abbey, and the villein in his wattle and daub cottage. All breathed the same polluted reek, and all died the same death of corruption. Of those who were stricken, none recovered, and the illness was ever the same. Gross boils, raving, and the black blotches which gave its name to the disease. All through the winter the dead rotted by the wayside for want of someone to bury them. In many a village no single man was left alive. Then, at last, the spring came, with sunshine and health, and lightness and laughter, the greenest, sweetest, tenderest spring that England had ever known. But only half of England could know it. The other half had passed away with the great purple cloud. Yet it was there, in that stream of death, in that reek of corruption, that the brighter and freer England was born. There, in that dark hour, the first streak of the new dawn was seen. For in no way save by a great upheaval and change could the nation break away from that iron feudal system which held her limbs. But now it was a new country which came out from that year of death. The barons were dead in swathes. No high turret nor cunning moat could keep out that black commoner who struck them down. Oppressive laws slackened for want of those who could enforce them, and once slackened could never be enforced again. The labourer would be a slave no longer. The bondsman snapped his shackles. There was much to do, and few left to do it. Therefore the few should be freemen, name their own price, and work where and for whom they would. It was the Black Death which cleared the way for that great rising 30 years later, which left the English peasant the freest of his class in Europe. But there were few so far-sighted that they could see that here, as ever, good was coming out of evil. At the moment, misery and ruin were brought into every family. The dead cattle, the ungarnered crops, the untilled lands, every spring of wealth had dried up at the same moment. Those who were rich became poor, but those who were poor already, and especially those who were poor with the burden of gentility upon their shoulders, found themselves in a perilous state. All through England the smaller gentry were ruined, for they had no trade save war, and they drew their living from the work of others. On many a manor house there came evil times, and on none more than on the manor of Tilford, where for many generations the noble family of the Lorings had held their home. There was a time when the Lorings had held the country from the North Downs to the lakes of Frensham, and when their grim castle keep, rising above the green meadows which bordered the River Wey, had been the strongest fortalice betwixt Guildford Castle in the east and Winchester in the west. But there came that Barons' War, in which the king used his Saxon subjects as a whip with which to scourge his Norman barons, and Castle Loring, like so many other great strongholds, was swept from the face of the land. From that time the Lorings, with estates sadly curtailed, lived in what had been the dower house, with enough for splendour. And then came their lawsuit with Waverley Abbey, and the Cistercians laid claim to their richest land, with peccary, turbary, and feudal rights over the remainder. It lingered on for years, this great lawsuit, and when it was finished, the men of the church and the men of the law had divided all that was richest of the estate between them. There was still left the old manor house, from which, with each generation, there came a soldier to uphold the credit of the name, and to show the 5 scarlet roses on the silver shield where it had always been shown, in the van. There were 12 bronzes in the little chapel, where Matthew the priest said mass every morning, all of men of the House of Loring. 2 lay with their legs crossed, as being from the Crusades. 6 others rested their feet upon lions, as having died in war. 4 only lay with the effigy of their hounds to show that they had passed in peace. Of this famous but impoverished family, doubly impoverished by law and by pestilence, 2 members were living in the year of grace 1349, Lady Ermyntrude Loring and her grandson Nigel. Lady Ermyntrude's husband had fallen before the Scottish spearsmen at Stirling, and her son Eustace, Nigel's father, had found a glorious death 9 years before this chronicle opens, upon the poop of a Norman galley, at the sea-fight of Sluy. The lonely old woman, fierce and brooding like the falcon mewed in her chamber, was soft only toward the lad whom she had brought up. All the tenderness and love of her nature, so hidden from others that they could not imagine their existence, were lavished upon him. She could not bear him away from her, and he, with that respect for authority which the age demanded, could not go without her blessing and consent. So it came about that Nigel, with his lion heart and with the blood of 100 soldiers thrilling in his veins, still at the age of 22, wasted the weary days reclaiming his hawks with leash and lure, or training the Alans and Spaniels who shared with the family the big earthen-floored hall of the manor house. Day by day, the aged Lady Ermyntrude had seen him wax in strength and in manhood. Small of stature, it is true, but with muscles of steel and a soul of fire. From all parts, from the warden of Guildford Castle, from the tilt-yard of Farnham, tales of his prowess were brought back to her, of his daring as a rider, of his debonair courage, of his skill with all weapons. But still she, who had both husband and son torn from her by a bloody death, could not bear that this, the last of the Lorings, the final bud of so famous an old tree, should share the same fate. With a weary heart, but with a smiling face, he bore with his uneventful days, while she would ever put off the evil time until the harvest was better, until the monks of Waverley should give up what they had taken, until his uncle should die and leave money for his outfit, or any other excuse with which she could hold him to her side. And indeed there was need for a man at Tilford, for the strife betwixt the abbey and the manor house had never been appeased. And still, on one pretext or another, the monks would clip off yet one more slice of their neighbour's land. Over the winding river, across the green meadows, rose the short square tower and the high grey walls of the grim abbey, with its bell tolling by day and night, a voice of menace and of dread to the little household. It is in the heart of the great Cistercian monastery that this chronicle of old days must take its start, as we trace the feud betwixt the monks and the House of Loring, with those events to which it gave birth, ending with the coming of Chandos and the strange spear-running at Tilford Bridge, and the deeds with which Nigel won fame in the wars. Elsewhere, in a chronicle of the White Company, it has been set forth what manner of man was Nigel Loring. Those who love him may read herein those things which went into his making. Let us go back together and gaze upon this green stage of England, the scenery, hill, plain and river, even as now, the actors, in much our very selves, in much also, so changed in thought and act, that they might be dwellers in another world to ours. End of chapter 1. Chapter 2 of Sir Nigel. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 2. How the Devil Came to Waverley. The day was the 1st of May, which was the festival of the blessed apostles Philip and James. The year was the 1349th from man's salvation. From Tius to Sext, and then again from Sext to Nones, Abbot John of the House of Waverley had been seated in his study while he conducted the many high duties of his office. All around, for many a mile on every side, stretched the fertile and flourishing estate of which he was the master. In the centre lay the broad abbey buildings, with church and cloisters, hospitium, chapter house and frater house, all buzzing with a busy life. Through the open window came the low hum of the voices of the brethren, as they walked in pious converse in the ambulatory below. From across the cloister there rolled the distant rise and fall of a Gregorian chant, where the precentor was hard at work upon the choir, while down in the chapter house sounded the strident voice of Brother Peter, expounding the rule of St. Bernard to the novices. Abbot John rose to stretch his cramped limbs. He looked out at the greensward of the cloister, and at the graceful line of open Gothic arches which skirted a covered walk for the brethren within. Two and two, in their black and white garb, with slow step and heads inclined, they paced round and round. Several of the more studious had brought their illuminating work from the scriptorium, and sat in the warm sunshine with their little platters of pigments and packets of gold leaf before them, their shoulders rounded, and their faces sunk low over the white sheets of vellum. There, too, was the copper worker, with his burin and graver. Learning and art were not traditions within the Cistercians, as with the parent order of the Benedictines, and yet the library of Waverley was well filled both with precious books and with pious students. But the true glory of the Cistercian lay in his outdoor work, and so ever and anon there passed through the cloister some sunburned monk, soiled mattock or shovel in hand, with his gown looped to his knee, fresh from the fields or the garden. The lush green water meadows speckled with the heavy-fleeced sheep, the acres of cornland reclaimed from heather and bracken, the vineyards of the southern slope of Crooksbury Hill, the rows of Hankley fish-ponds, the Frensham marshes, drained and sown with vegetables, the spacious pigeon-cots all circled the great abbey round with the visible labours of the order. The abbot's full and florid face shone with a quiet content as he looked out at his huge but well-ordered household. Like every head of a prosperous abbey, Abbot John, the fourth of the name, was a man of various accomplishments. Through his own chosen instruments he had to minister a great estate, and to keep order and decorum among a large body of men living a celibate life. He was a rigid disciplinarian towards all beneath him, a supple diplomatist to all above. He held high debate with neighbouring abbots and lords, with bishops, with papal legates, and even, on occasion, with the King's Majesty himself. Many were the subjects with which he must be conversant. Questions of doctrine, questions of building, points of forestry, of agriculture, of drainage, of feudal law, all came to the abbot for settlement. He held the scales of justice in all the Abbey Bolnia, which stretched over many a mile of Hampshire and of Surrey. To the monks his displeasure might mean fasting, exile to some sterner community, or even imprisonment in chains. Over the layman he could also hold any punishment save only corporeal death, instead of which he had in hand the far more dreadful weapon of spiritual excommunication. Such were the powers of the abbot, and it is no wonder that there were masterful lines in the ruddy features of Abbot John, or that the brethren, glancing up, should put on an even meeker carriage and more demure expression as they saw the watchful face in the window above them. A knock at the door of his studio recalled the abbot to his immediate duties, and he returned to his desk. Already he had spoken with his cellarer and prior, almoner, chaplain, and lector, but now, in the tall and gaunt monk who obeyed his summons to enter, he recognised the most important, and also the most importunate, of his agents, Brother Samuel the Sacrist, whose office, corresponding to that of the layman's bailiff, placed the material interests of the monastery and its dealings with the outer world entirely under his control, subject only to the check of the abbot. Brother Samuel was a gnarled and stringy old monk, whose stern and sharp-featured face reflected no light from above, but only that sordid workaday world towards which it was forever turned. A huge book of accounts was tucked under one of his arms, while a great bunch of keys hung from the other hand, a badge of his office, and also, on occasion of impatience, a weapon of offence, as many a scarred head among rustics and lay-brothers could testify. The abbot sighed wearily, for he suffered much at the hands of his strenuous agent. "Well, Brother Samuel, what is your will?" he asked. "Holy Father, I have to report that I have sold the wool to Master Baldwin of Winchester at 2 shillings a bale more than it fetched last year, for the murrain among the sheep has raised the price." "You have done well, brother." "I have also to tell you that I have distrained Wat the Warrener from his cottage, for his Christmas rent is still unpaid, nor the hen rents of last year."
"He has a wife and 4 children, brother."
He was a good, easy man, the abbot, though liable to be overborne by his sterner subordinate.
"It is true, Holy Father, But if I should pass him, then how am I to ask the rent of the foresters of Puttenham, or the hinds in the village? Such a thing spreads from house to house, and where then is the wealth of Waverley? What else, Brother Samuel? There is the matter of the fish ponds. The abbot's face brightened. It was a subject upon which he was an authority. If the rule of his order had robbed him of the softer joys of life, he had the keener zest for those which remained. How have the char prospered, brother? They have done well, holy father, but the carp have died in the abbot's pond. Carp prosper only upon a gravel bottom. They must be put in also in their due proportion. 3 milters to 1 spawner, brother sacrist, and the spot must be free from wind, stony and sandy, an ell deep with willows and grass upon the banks. Mud for tench, brother, gravel for carp. The sacrist leaned forward with the face of one who bears tidings of woe. There are pike in the abbot's pond, said he.
Pike! Cried the abbot in horror. As well shut up a wolf in our sheepfold! How came a pike in the pond? There were no pike last year, and a pike does not fall with the rain nor rise in the springs. The pond must be drained, and we shall spend next Lent upon stockfish, and have the brethren down with the great sickness ere Easter Sunday has come to absolve us from our abstinence. The pond shall be drained, holy father. I have already ordered it. Then we shall plant pot-herbs on the mud bottom, and after we have gathered them in, return the fish and water once more from the lower pond, so that they may fatten among the rich stubble.
Good, cried the abbot. I would have 3 fish stews in every well-ordered house, one for dry herbs, one shallow for the fry and the yearlings, and one deep for the breeders and the table fish.
But still, I have not heard how you say the pike came in the abbot's pond.
A spasm of anger passed over the fierce face of the sacrist, and his keys rattled as his bony hand clasped them more tightly. Young Nigel Loring, said he. He swore that he would do a scathe, and in this way he has done it.
How know you this?
6 weeks ago he was seen day by day fishing for pike at the great lake of Frensham. Twice at night he has been met with a bundle of straw under his arm on the Hankley Down. Well, I wot that the straw was wet, and that a live pike lay within it.
The abbot shook his head. I have heard much of this youth's wild ways, but now indeed he has passed all bounds, if what you'd say be truth.
It was bad enough when it was said that he slew the king's deer in Woolmer Chase, or broke the head of Hobbs the chapman, so that he lay for 7 days betwixt life and death in our infirmary, saved only by Brother Peter's skill in the pharmacies of herbs. But to put a pike in the abbot's pond, why should he play such a devil's prank?
Because he hates the house of Waverley, holy father, because he swears that we hold his father's land.
In which there is surely some truth,
but, holy father, we hold no more than the law has allowed.
True, brother, and yet, between ourselves, we may admit that the heavier purse may weigh down the scales of justice. When I have passed the old house, and have seen that aged woman, with her ruddled cheeks and her baleful eyes, look the curses she dare not speak, I have many a time wished that we had other neighbours.
That we can soon bring about, holy father. Indeed, it is of it that I wish to speak to you. Surely it is not hard for us to drive them from the countryside. There are 30 years of claims of escuage unsettled. And there is Sergeant Wilkins, the lawyer of Guildford, whom I will warrant to draw up such arrears of dues and rents, and issues of hidage and foddercorn, that these folk, who are as beggarly as they are proud, will have to sell the roof-tree over them ere they can meet them. Within 3 days I will have them at our mercy. They are an ancient family, and of good repute. I would not treat them too harshly, brother.
Bethink you of the pike in the carp pond.
The abbot hardened his heart at the thought.
It was indeed a devil's deed. When we had but newly stocked it with char and with carp, well,
the law is the law, and if you can use it to hurt, it is still lawful to do so.
Have these claims been advanced?
Deacon the bailiff, with his 2 varlets, went down to the hall yesternight on the matter of the escuage, and came screaming back with this young hothead raging at their heels. He is small and slight, yet he has the strength of many men in the hour of his wrath. The bailiff swears that he will go no more save with half a score of archers to uphold him. The abbot was red with anger at this new offence. I will teach him that the servants of Holy Church, even though we of the rule of St. Bernard be the lowliest and humblest of her children, can still defend their own against the forward and the violent. Go cite this man before the abbey court. Let him appear in the chapter house after tierce tomorrow. But the wary sacrist shook his head. Nay, holy father, the times are not yet ripe. Give me 3 days, I pray you, that my case against him may be complete. Bear in mind that the father and the grandfather of this unruly squire were both famous men of their day, and the foremost knights in the king's own service, living in high honour and dying in their knightly duty. The Lady Ermyntrude Loring was first lady to the king's mother. Roger FitzAlan of Farnham and Sir Hugh Walcott of Guildford Castle were each old comrades-in-arms of Nigel's father, and sibbed to him on the distaff side. Already there has been talk that we have dealt harshly with them. Therefore, my rede is that we be wise and wary, and wait until his cup be indeed full. The abbot had opened his mouth to reply, when the consultation was interrupted by a most unwonted buzz of excitement from among the monks in the cloister below. Questions and answers in excited voices sounded from one side of the ambulatory to the other. Sacrist and abbot were gazing at each other in amazement at such a breach of the discipline and decorum of their well-trained flock, when there came a swift step upon the stair, and a white-faced brother flung open the door and rushed into the room. "Father Abbot," he cried, "alas, alas! Brother John is dead, and the holy sub-prior is dead, and the devil is loose in the Five Vergate field." End of chapter 2. Chapter 3 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 3. The Yellow Horse of Crooksbury. In those simple times there was a great wonder and mystery in life. Man walked in fear and solemnity, with heaven very close above his head, and hell below his very feet. God's visible hand was everywhere, in the rainbow and the comet, in the thunder and the wind. The devil, too, raged openly upon the earth. He skulked behind the hedgerows in the gloaming. He laughed loudly in the night-time. He clawed the dying sinner, pounced on the unbaptized babe, and twisted the limbs of the epileptic. A foul fiend slunk ever by a man's side, and whispered villainies in his ear, while above him there hovered an angel of grace, who pointed to the steep and narrow track. How could one doubt these things, when pope and priest and scholar and king were all united in believing them, with no single voice of question in the whole wide world? Every book read, every picture seen, every tale heard from nurse or mother, all taught the same lesson. And as a man travelled through the world, his faith would grow the firmer, for go where he would, there were the endless shrines of the saints, each with its holy relic in the centre, and around it the tradition of incessant miracles, with stacks of deserted crutches and silver votive hearts to prove them. At every turn he was made to feel how thin was the veil, and how easily rent, which screened him from the awful denizens of the unseen world. Hence the wild announcement of the frightened monk seemed terrible rather than incredible to those who he addressed. The abbot's ruddy face paled for a moment, it is true, but he plucked the crucifix from his desk and rose valiantly to his feet. "Lead me to him," said he. "Show me the foul fiend who dares to lay his grip upon brethren of the holy house of St. Bernard. Run down to my chaplain, brother. Bid him bring the exorcist with him, and also the blessed box of relics, and the bones of St. James from under the altar. With these, and a contrite and humble heart, we may show front to all the powers of darkness." But the sacrist was of a more critical turn of mind. He clutched the monk's arm with a grip which left its 5 purple spots for many a day to come. "Is this the way to enter the abbot's own chamber, without knock or reverence, or so much as a pax vobiscum?" he said sternly.
You were wont to be our gentlest novice, of lowly carriage in chapter, devout in psalmody and strict in cloister. Pull your wits together, and answer me straightly. In what form has the foul fiend appeared, and how has he done this grievous scathe to our brethren? Have you seen him with your own eyes, or do you repeat from hearsay? Speak, man, or you stand on the penance stool in the chapter house this very hour. Thus adjured, the frightened monk grew calmer in his bearing, though his white lips and his startled eyes, with the gasping of his breath, told of his inward tremors. If it please you, holy father, and you, reverend sacrist, it came about in this way. James the subprior and brother John and I spent our day from Sext onward on Hankley, cutting bracken for the cowhouses. We were coming back over the Five Virgate field, and the holy subprior was telling us a saintly tale from the life of St. Gregory, when there came a sudden sound like a rushing torrent, and the foul fiend sprang over the high wall which skirts the water meadow, and rushed upon us with the speed of the wind. The lay brother he struck to the ground and trampled into the mire. Then, seizing the good subprior in his teeth, he rushed round the field, swinging him as though he were a fardle of old clothes. Amazed at such a sight, I stood without movement and had said a credo and three aves, when the devil dropped the subprior and sprang upon me. With the help of St. Bernard, I clambered over the wall, but not before his teeth had found my leg, and he had torn away the whole back skirt of my gown. As he spoke, he turned and gave corroboration to his story by the hanging ruins of his long trailing garment. "In what shape, then, did Satan appear?" the abbot demanded. "As a great yellow horse, holy father, a monster horse with eyes of fire and teeth of a griffin." "A yellow horse?" The sacrist glared at the scared monk. "You foolish brother, how will you behave when you have indeed to face the King of Terrors himself, if you can be so frightened by the sight of a yellow horse?" "It is the horse of Franklin Aylward, my father, which has been distrained by us because he owes the abbey 50 good shillings and can never hope to pay it. Such a horse, they say, is not to be found betwixt this and the king's stables at Windsor, for his sire was a Spanish destrier and his dam an Arab mare, of the very breed which Saladin, whose soul now reeks in hell, kept for his own use, and even, it has been said, under the shelter of his own tent. I took him in discharge of the debt, and I ordered the varlets, who had halted him, to leave him alone in the water meadow, for I have heard that the beast has indeed a most evil spirit, and has killed more men than one." "It was an ill day for Waverley that you brought such a monster within its bounds," said the abbot. "If the subprior and brother John be indeed dead, then it would seem that, if the horse be not the devil, he is at least the devil's instrument." "Horse or devil, holy father, I heard him shout with joy as he trampled upon brother John, and had you seen him tossing the subprior as a dog shakes a rat, you would perchance have felt even as I did." "Come then," cried the abbot, "let us see with our own eyes what evil has been done." And the three monks hurried down the stair which led to the cloisters. They had no sooner descended than their more pressing fears were set at rest, for at that very moment, limping, dishevelled, and mud-stained, the two sufferers were being led in amid a crowd of sympathizing brethren. Shouts and cries from outside showed, however, that some further drama was in progress, and both abbot and sacrist hastened onward as fast as the dignity of their office would permit, until they had passed the gates and gained the wall of the meadow. Looking over it, a remarkable sight presented itself to their eyes. Fetlock deep in the lush grass, there stood a magnificent horse, such a horse as a sculptor or a soldier might thrill to see. His colour was a light chestnut, with mane and tail of a more tawny tint. 17 hands high, with a barrel and haunches which bespoke tremendous strength, he fined down to the most delicate lines of dainty breed in neck and crest and shoulder. He was, indeed, a glorious sight as he stood there, his beautiful body leaning back from his wide-spread and propped forelegs, his head craned high, his ears erect, his mane bristling, his red nostrils opening and shutting with wrath, and his flashing eyes turning from side to side in haughty menace and defiance. Scattered round, in a respectful circle, six of the abbey lay-servants and foresters, each holding a halter, were creeping toward him. Every now and then, with a beautiful toss and swerve and plunge, the great creature would turn upon one of his would-be captors, and with outstretched head, flying mane, and flashing teeth, would chase him, screaming, to the safety of the wall, while the others would close swiftly in behind and cast their ropes, in the hope of catching neck or leg, but only in their turn to be chased to the nearest refuge. Had two of these ropes settled upon the horse, and had their throwers found some purchase of stump or boulder, by which they could hold them, then the man's brain might have won its wonted victory over the swiftness and strength. But the brains were themselves at fault, which had imagined that one such rope would serve any purpose save to endanger the thrower. Yet so it was, and what might have been foreseen occurred at that very moment of the arrival of the monks. The horse, having chased one of his enemies to the wall, remained so long snorting his contempt over the coping that the others were able to creep upon him from behind. Several ropes were flung, and one noose settled over the proud crest and lost itself in the waving mane. In an instant the creature had turned, and the men were flying for their lives, but he who had cast the rope lingered, uncertain what use to make of his own success. That moment of doubt was fatal. With a yell of dismay, the man saw the great creature rear above him, then with a crash the forefeet fell upon him and dashed him to the ground. He rose, screaming, was hurled over once more, and lay a quivering, bleeding heap, while the savage horse, the most cruel and terrible in its anger of all creatures on earth, bit and shook and trampled the writhing body. A loud wail of horror rose from the lines of tonsured heads which skirted the high wall, a wail which suddenly died away into a long, hushed silence, broken at last by a rapturous cry of thanksgiving and of joy. On the road which led to the old dark manor-house upon the side of the hill, a youth had been riding. His mount was a sorry one, a weedy, shambling, long-haired colt, and his patched tunic of faded purple with stained leather belt presented no very smart appearance. Yet, in the bearing of the man, in the poise of his head, in his easy, graceful carriage, and in the bold glance of his large blue eyes, there was that stamp of distinction and of breed which would have given him a place of his own in any assembly. He was of small stature, but his frame was singularly elegant and graceful. His face, though tanned with the weather, was delicate in features, and most eager and alert in expression. A thick fringe of crisp yellow curls broke from under the dark flat cap which he was wearing, and a short golden beard hid the outline of his strong square chin. One white osprey feather, thrust through a gold brooch in the front of his cap, gave a touch of grace to his sombre garb. This and other points of his attire, the short hanging mantle, the leather-sheathed hunting knife, the cross-belt which sustained a brazen horn, the soft doe-skin boots and the prick-spurs, would all disclose themselves to an observer. But at the first glance, the brown face, set in gold and the dancing light of the quick, reckless, laughing eyes, were the one strong memory left behind. Such was the youth who, cracking his whip joyously and followed by half a score of dogs, cantered on his rude pony down the Tilford Lane, and thence it was that, with a smile of amused contempt upon his face, he observed the comedy in the field, and the impotent efforts of the servants of Waverley. Suddenly, however, as the comedy turned swiftly to black tragedy, this passive spectator leapt into quick, strenuous life. With a spring, he was off his pony, and with another, he was over the stone wall and flying swiftly across the field. Looking up from his victim, the great yellow horse saw this other enemy approach, and spurning the prostrate but still writhing body with its heels, dashed at the newcomer. But this time there was no hasty flight, no rapturous pursuit to the wall. The little man braced himself straight, flung up his metal-headed whip, and met the horse with a crashing blow upon the head, repeated again and again with every attack. In vain the horse reared and tried to overthrow its enemy with swooping shoulders and pawing hoofs. Cool, swift, and alert, the man sprang swiftly aside from under the very shadow of death, and then again came the swish and thud of the unerring blow from the heavy handle. The horse drew off, glared with wonder and fury at this masterful man, and then trotted round in a circle with mane bristling, tail streaming and ears on end, snorting in its rage and pain. The man, hardly deigning to glance at his fell neighbour, passed on to the wounded forester, raised him in his arms with a strength which could not have been expected in so slight a body, and carried him groaning to the wall, where a dozen hands were outstretched to help him over. Then, at his leisure, the young man also climbed the wall, smiling back with cool contempt at the yellow horse, which had come raging after him once more. As he sprang down, a dozen monks surrounded him to thank him or to praise him, but he would have turned sullenly away without a word had he not been stopped by Abbot John in person. "Nay, Squire Loring," said he, "if you be a bad friend to our abbey, yet we must needs own that you have played the part of a good Christian this day, for if there is breath left in our servant's body, it is to you, next to our blessed patron St. Bernard, that we owe it." "By St. Paul, I owe you no goodwill, Abbot John," said the young man. "The shadow of your abbey has ever fallen across the house of Loring. As to any small deed that I may have done this day, I ask no thanks for it. It is not for you nor for your house that I have done it, but only because it was my pleasure to do so." The abbot flushed at the bold words, and bit his lip with vexation. It was the sacrist, however, who answered. "It would be more fitting and more gracious," said he, "if you were to speak to the Holy Father Abbot in a manner suited to his high rank and to the respect which is due to a prince of the church." The youth turned his bold blue eyes upon the monk, and his sunburned face darkened with anger. "Were it not for the gown upon your back, and for your silvering hair, I would answer you in another fashion," said he. "You are the lean wolf which growls ever at our door, greedy for the little which hath been left to us. Say and do what you will with me, but by St. Paul, if I find that Dame Ermyntrude is baited by your ravenous pack, I will beat them off with this whip from the little patch which still remains of all the acres of my father's." "Have a care, Nigel Loring, have a care," cried the abbot, with finger upraised. "Have you no fears of the law of England?" "A just law I fear and obey." "Have you no respect for Holy Church?" "I respect all that is holy in her. I do not respect those who grind the poor or steal their neighbour's land." "Rash man, many a one has been blighted by her ban for less than you have now said." "And yet it is not for us to judge you harshly this day. You are young, and hot words come easily to your lips. How fares the forester?"
"His hurt is grievous, Father Abbot, but he will live," said a brother, looking up from the prostrate form. "With a bloodletting and an electuary, I will warrant him sound within a month."
"Then bear him to the hospital. And now, brother, about this terrible beast who still gazes and snorts at us over the top of the wall, as though his thoughts of Holy Church were as uncouth as those of Squire Nigel himself. What are we to do with him?"
"Here is Franklin Aylward," said one of the brethren. "The horse was his, and doubtless he will take it back to his farm."
But the stout, red-faced farmer shook his head at the proposal.
"Not I, in faith," said he. "The beast hath chased me twice round the paddock. It has nigh slain my boy Samkin. He would never be happy till he had ridden it, nor has he ever been happy since. There is not a hind in my employ who will enter his stall. Ill fare the day that ever I took the beast from the castle stud at Guildford, where they could do nothing with it, and no rider could be found bold enough to mount it. When the sacrist here took it for a 50-shilling debt, he made his own bargain and must abide by it. He comes no more to the Crooksbury farm."
"And he stays no more here," said the abbot. "Brother sacrist, you have raised the devil, and it is for you to lay it again."
"That I will most readily," cried the sacrist. "A pittance, master, can stop the 50 shillings from my very own weekly dole, and so the abbey be none the poorer. In the meantime, here is Wat with his arbalest, and a bolt in his girdle. Let him drive it to the head through this cursed creature, for his hide and his hoofs are of more value than his wicked self." A hard, brown old woodman, who had been shooting vermin in the abbey groves, stepped forward with a grin of pleasure. After a lifetime of stoats and foxes, this was indeed a noble quarry which was to fall before him. Fitting a bolt on the nut of his taut crossbow, he raised it to his shoulder, and levelled it at the fierce, proud, dishevelled head which tossed in savage freedom at the other side of the wall. His finger was crooked on the spring when a blow from a whip struck the bow upward, and the bolt flew harmlessly over the abbey orchard, while the woodman shrank abashed from Nigel Loring's angry eyes. "Keep your bolts for your weasels," said he. "Would you take life from a creature whose only fault is that its spirit is so high that it has met none yet who dare control it? You would slay such a horse as a king might be proud to mount, and all because a country franklin or a monk or a monk's varlet has not the wit nor the hands to master him." The sacrist turned swiftly on the squire. "The abbey owes you an offering for this day's work, however rude your words may be," he said. "If you think so much of the horse, you may desire to own it. If I am to pay for it, then, with the holy abbot's permission, it is my gift, and I bestow it freely upon you." The abbot plucked at his subordinate's sleeve. "Bethink you, brother sacrist," he whispered, "shall we not have this man's blood upon our heads?"
"His pride is as stubborn as the horse's, holy father," the sacrist answered, his gaunt face breaking into a malicious smile. "Man or beast, one will break the other, and the world will be better for it. If you forbid me—"
"Nay, nay, brother. You have bought the horse, and you may have the bestowal of it."
"Then I give it, hide and hoofs, and tail and temper, to Nigel Loring, and may it be as sweet and as gentle to him as he hath been to the Abbot of Waverley."
The sacrist spoke aloud amid the tittering of the monks, for the man concerned was out of earshot. At the first words which had shown him the turn which affairs had taken, he had run swiftly to the spot where he had left his pony. From its mouth he removed the bit and the stout bridle which held it. Then, leaving the creature to nibble the grass by the wayside, he sped back whence he came. "I take your gift, monk," said he, "though I know well why it is that you give it. Yet I thank you, for there are two things upon earth for which I have ever yearned, and which my thin purse could never buy. The one is a noble horse, such a horse as my father's son should have betwixt his thighs, and here is the one of all others which I would have chosen, since some small deed is to be done in the winning of him, and some honourable advancement to be gained. How is the horse called?"
"Its name," said the franklin, "is Pommers. I warn you, young sir, that none may ride him, for many have tried, and the luckiest is he who has only a staved rib to show for it."
"I thank you for your rede," said Nigel, "and now I see that it is indeed a horse which I would journey far to meet."
"I am your man, Pommers, and you are my horse, and this night you shall own it, or I will never need horse again."
"My spirit against thine, and God hold thy spirit high, Pommers, so that the greater be the adventure and the more hope of honour gained."
While he spoke, the young squire had climbed onto the top of the wall and stood there, balanced, the very image of grace and spirit and gallantry, his bridle hanging from one hand and his whip grasped in the other. With a fierce snort, the horse made for him instantly, and his white teeth flashed as he snapped, but again a heavy blow from the loaded whip caused him to swerve, and even at the instant of the swerve, measuring the distance with steady eyes and bending his supple body for the spring, Nigel bounded into the air and fell with his legs astride the broad back of the yellow horse. For a minute, with neither saddle nor stirrups to help him, and the beast ramping and rearing like a mad thing beneath him, he was hard pressed to hold his own. His legs were like two bands of steel welded onto the swelling arches of the great horse's ribs, and his left hand was buried deep in the tawny mane. Never had the dull round of the lives of the gentle brethren of Waverley been broken by so fiery a scene. Springing to right and swooping to left, now with its tangled wicked head betwixt its forefeet, and now pawing 8 feet in the air, with scarlet furious nostrils and maddened eyes, the yellow horse was a thing of terror and of beauty. But the lithe figure on his back, bending like a reed in the wind to every movement, firm below, pliant above, with calm, inexorable face, and eyes which danced and gleamed with the joy of contest, still held its masterful place for all that the fiery heart and the iron muscles of the great beast could do. Once a long drone of dismay rose from the monks, as rearing higher and higher, yet a last mad effort sent the creature toppling over backward upon its rider. But swift and cool he had writhed from under it ere it fell, spurned it with his foot as it rolled upon the earth, and then, seizing its mane as it rose, swung himself lightly onto its back once more. Even the grim sacrist could not but join the cheer as Pommers, amazed to find the rider still upon his back, plunged and curvetted down the field. But the wild horse only swelled into a greater fury.
In the sudden gloom of its untamed heart there rose the furious resolve to dash the life from this clinging rider, even if it meant destruction to beast and man. With red, blazing eyes it looked round for death. On three sides the five Virgate field was bounded by a high wall, broken only at one spot by a heavy 4-foot wooden gate. But on the fourth side was a low grey building, one of the granges of the abbey, presenting a long flank unbroken by door or window. The horse stretched itself into a gallop and headed straight for the craggy 30-foot wall. He would break in red ruin at the base of it if he could, but dash forever the life of this man who claimed mastery over that which had never found its master yet. The great haunches gathered under it, the eager hoofs drummed the grass as faster and still more fast the frantic horse bore himself and his rider toward the wall. Would Nigel spring off? To do so would be to bend his will to that of the beast beneath him. There was a better way than that. Cool and quick and decided, the man swiftly passed both whip and bridle into the left hand which still held the mane. Then, with a right, he slipped his short mantle from his shoulders, and lying forward along the creature's strenuous, rippling back, he cast the flapping cloth over the horse's eyes. The result was but too successful, for it nearly brought about the downfall of the rider. When those red eyes, straining for death, were suddenly shrouded in unexpected darkness, the amazed horse propped on its forefeet and came to so dead a stop that Nigel was shot forward onto its neck and hardly held himself by his hair-entwined hand. Ere he had slid back into position, the moment of danger had passed. For the horse, its purpose all blurred in its mind by this strange thing which had befallen, wheeled round once more, trembling in every fibre, and tossing its petulant head, until at last the mantle had been slipped from its eyes, and the chilling darkness had melted into the homely circle of sunlit grass once more. But what was this new outrage which had been inflicted upon it? What was this defiling bar of iron which had locked hard against its mouth? What were these straps which galled the tossing neck, this band which spanned its chest? In those instants of stillness, ere the mantle had been plucked away, Nigel had lain forward, had slipped the snaffle between the champing teeth, and deftly secured it. Blind, frantic fury surged in the yellow horse's heart once more at this new degradation, this badge of serfdom and infamy. His spirit rose high and menacing at the touch. He loathed this place, these people, all and everything which threatened his freedom. He would have done with them forever. He would see them no more. Let him away to the uttermost parts of the earth, to the great plains where freedom is. Anywhere over the far horizon where he could get away from this defiling bit and the insufferable mastery of man. He turned with a rush, and one magnificent deer-like bound carried him over the 4-foot gate. Nigel's hat had flown off, and his yellow curls streamed behind him as he rose and fell in the leap. They were in the water meadow now, and the rippling stream, 20 feet wide, gleamed in front of them, running down to the main current of the way. The yellow horse gathered his haunches under him and flew over like an arrow. He took off from behind a boulder and cleared a furze bush on the further side. 2 stones still mark the leap from hoof-mark to hoof-mark, and they are 11 good paces apart. Under the hanging branch of the great oak tree on the further side, that Quercus tilfordiensis audiensis is still shown as the bound of the abbey's immediate precincts. The great horse passed. He had hoped to sweep off his rider, but Nigel sank low on the heaving back with his face buried in the flying mane. The rough bough rasped him rudely, but never shook his spirit nor his grip. Rearing, plunging, and struggling, Pommers broke through the sapling grove and was out on the broad stretch of Hankley Down. And now came such a ride as still lingers in the gossip of the lowly country folk, and forms the rude jingle of that old Surrey ballad, now nearly forgotten, save for the refrain, "The doe that sped on hind head, the kestrel on the wind, and Nigel on the yellow horse can leave the world behind." Before them lay a rolling ocean of dark heather, knee-deep, swelling in billow on billow, up to the clear-cut hill before them. Above stretched one unbroken arch of peaceful blue, with a sun which was sinking down towards the Hampshire hills. Through the deep heather, down the gullies, over the watercourses, up the broken slopes, Pommers flew, his great heart bursting with rage, and every fibre quivering at the indignities which he had endured. And still, do what he would,
The man clung fast to his heaving sides and to his flying mane, silent, motionless, inexorable, letting him do what he would, but fixed as fate upon his purpose. Over Hankley Down, through Thursley Marsh, with the reeds up to his mud-splashed withers, onward up the long slope of the headland of the Hinds, down by the Nutcombe Gorge, slipping, blundering, bounding, but never slackening his fearful speed, on went the great yellow horse. The villagers of Shottermill heard the wild clatter of hoofs, but ere they could swing the oxhide curtains of their cottage doors, horse and rider were lost amid the high bracken of the Haslemere Valley. On he went, and on, tossing the miles behind his flying hoofs. No marshland could clog him, no hill could hold him back. Up the slope of Lynchmere and the long ascent of Fernhurst he thundered on as on the level. And it was not until he had flown down the incline of Henley Hill and the grey castle tower of Midhurst rose over the coppice in front that at last the eager outstretched neck sank a little on the breast and the breath came quick and fast. Look where he would in woodland and on down, his straining eyes could catch no sight of those plains of freedom which he sought. And yet another outrage. It was bad that this creature should still cling so tight upon his back, but now he would even go to the intolerable length of checking him and guiding him on the way which he would have him go. There was a sharp pluck at his mouth, and his head was turned north once more. As well go that way as another, but the man was mad indeed if he thought that such a horse as Pommers was at the end of his spirit or his strength. He would soon show him that he was unconquered, if it strained his sinews and broke his heart to do so. Back then he flew up the long, long ascent. Would he ever get to the end of it? Yet he would not own that he could go no further while the man still kept his grip. He was white with foam and caked with mud. His eyes were gorged with blood, his mouth open and gasping, his nostrils expanded, his coat stark and reeking. On he flew down the long Sunday hill until he reached the deep Kingsley Marsh at the bottom. No, it was too much. Flesh and blood could go no further. As he struggled out from the reedy slime, with the heavy black mud still clinging to his fetlocks, he at last eased down with sobbing breath and slowed the tumultuous gallop to a canter. Oh, crowning infamy! Was there no limit to these degradations? He was no longer even to choose his own pace. Since he had chosen to gallop so far at his own will, he must now gallop farther still at the will of another. A spur struck home on either flank. A stinging whiplash fell across his shoulder. He bounded his own height in the air at the pain and the shame of it. Then, forgetting his weary limbs, forgetting his panting, reeking sides, forgetting everything save this intolerable insult and the burning spirit within, he plunged off once more upon his furious gallop. He was out on the heather slopes again and heading for Weydown Common. On he flew, and on. But again his brain failed him, and again his limbs trembled beneath him. And yet again he strove to ease his pace, only to be driven onward by the cruel spur and the falling lash. He was blind and giddy with fatigue. He saw no longer where he placed his feet. He cared no longer whither he went. But his one mad longing was to get away from this dreadful thing, this torture which clung to him and would not let him go. Through Thursley village he passed, his eyes straining in his agony, his heart bursting within him. And he had won his way to the crest of Thursley Down, still stung forward by stab and blow, when his spirit weakened, his giant strength ebbed out of him, and with one deep sob of agony the yellow horse sank among the heather. So sudden was the fall that Nigel flew forward over his shoulder, and beast and man lay prostrate and gasping, while the last red rim of the sun sank beneath the Butser, and the first stars gleamed in a violet sky. The young squire was the first to recover, and kneeling by the panting, overwrought horse, he passed his hand gently over the tangled mane and down the foam-flecked face. The red eye rolled up at him, but it was wonder, not hatred, a prayer and not a threat which he could read in it. As he stroked the reeking muzzle, the horse whinnied gently and thrust his nose into the hollow of his hand. It was enough. It was the end of the contest, the acceptance of new conditions by a chivalrous foe from a chivalrous victor. "You are my horse, Pommers," Nigel whispered, and he laid his cheek against the craning head. "I know you, Pommers, and you know me. and with the help of St. Paul, we shall teach some other folk to know us both. Now, let us walk together as far as this moorland pond, for, indeed, I wot not whether it is you or I who need the water most." And so it was that some belated monks of Waverley, passing homeward from the outer farms, saw a strange sight which they carried on with them, so that it reached that very night the ears of both sacrist and of abbot. For as they passed through Tilford, they had seen horse and man walking side by side and head by head up the manor house lane. And when they had raised their lanterns on the pair, it was none other than the young squire himself who was leading home, as a shepherd leads a lamb, the fearsome yellow horse of Crooksbury. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of Sir Nigel. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Read by Clive Catterall. Sir Nigel by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. Chapter 4. How the Summoner Came to the Manor House of Tilford. By the date of this chronicle, the ascetic sternness of the old Norman castles had been humanized and refined, so that the new dwellings of the nobility, if less imposing in appearance, were much more comfortable as places of residence. A gentle race had built their houses rather for peace than for war. He who compares the savage bareness of Pevensey or Guildford with the piled grandeur of Bodmin or Windsor cannot fail to understand the change in manners which they represent. The earlier castles had a set purpose, for they were built that the invaders might hold down the country. But when the conquest was once firmly established, a castle had lost its meaning save as a refuge from justice or as a centre for civil strife. On the marches of Wales and of Scotland, the castle might continue to be a bulwark to the kingdom, and there still grew and flourished. But in all other places they were rather a menace to the king's majesty, and as such were discouraged and destroyed. By the reign of the third Edward, the greater part of the old fighting castles had been converted into dwelling-houses, or had been ruined in the civil wars, and left where their grim grey bones are still littered upon the brows of our hills. The new buildings were either great country houses, capable of defence, but mainly residential, or they were manor houses with no military significance at all. Such was the Tilford Manor House, where the last survivors of the old and magnificent House of Loring still struggled hard to keep a footing, and to hold off the monks and the lawyers from the few acres which were left to them. The mansion was a two-storied one, framed in heavy beams of wood, the interstices filled with rude blocks of stone. An outside staircase led up to several sleeping rooms above. Below there were only two apartments, the smaller of which was the bower of the aged Lady Ermyntrude. The other was the hall, a very large room which served as a living room of the family, and as the common dining room of themselves and of their little group of servants and retainers. The dwellings of these servants, the kitchens, the offices and the stables were all represented by a row of penthouses and sheds behind the main building. Here lived Charles the Page, Peter the Old Falconer, Red Swire, who had followed Nigel's grandfather to the Scottish Wars, Weathercoat the Broken Minstrel, John the Cook, and other survivors of more prosperous days, who still clung to the old house as the barnacles to some wrecked and stranded vessel. One evening, about a week after the breaking of the Yellow Horse, Nigel and his grandmother sat on either side of the large empty fireplace in this spacious apartment. The supper had been removed, and so had the trestle tables upon which it had been served, so that the room seemed bare and empty. The stone floor was strewed with a thick layer of green rushes, which was swept out every Saturday and carried with it all the dirt and debris of the week. Several dogs were now crouched among these rushes, gnawing and cracking the bones which had been thrown from the table. A long wooden buffet, loaded with plates and dishes, filled one end of the room, but there was little other furniture, save some benches against the walls, two Dorseret chairs, one small table littered with chessmen, and a great iron coffer. In one corner was a high wickerwork stand, and on it two stately falcons were perched, silent and motionless,
save for an occasional twinkle in their fierce yellow eyes. But if the actual fittings of the room would have appeared scanty to one who had lived in a more luxurious age, he would have been surprised on looking up to see the multitude of objects which were suspended above his head. Over the fireplace were the coats of arms of a number of houses allied by blood or by marriage to the Lorings. The two cresset lights which flared upon each side gleamed upon the blue lion of the Percys, the red birds of De Valence, the black engrailed cross of De Mun, the silver star of De Vere, and the ruddy bars of Fitzalan, all grouped round the famous red roses on the silver shield, which the Lorings had borne to glory upon many a bloody field. Then from side to side the room was spanned by heavy oaken beams, from which a great number of objects were hanging. There were mail shirts of obsolete pattern, several shields, one or two rusted and battered helmets, bowstaves, lances, otter spears, harness, fishing rods, and other implements of war or of the chase, while higher still, amid the black shadows of the peaked roof, could be seen rows of hams, flitches of bacon, salted geese, and those other forms of preserved meat which played so great a part in the housekeeping of the Middle Ages. Dame Ermyntrude Loring, daughter, wife, and mother of warriors, was herself a formidable figure. Tall and gaunt, with hard, craggy features and intolerant dark eyes, even her snow-white hair and stooping back could not entirely remove the sense of fear which she inspired in those around her. Her thoughts and memories went back to harsher times, and she looked upon the England around her as a degenerate and effeminate land, which had fallen away from the old standard of knightly courtesy and valour. The rising power of the people, the growing wealth of the church, the increasing luxury in life and manners, and the gentler tone of the age were all equally abhorrent to her, so that the dread of her fierce face, and even of the heavy oak staff with which she was supported her failing limbs, was widespread through all the country round. Yet if she was feared, she was also respected, for in days when books were few and readers scarce, a long memory and a ready tongue were of the more value. And where, save from Dame Ermyntrude, could the young, unlettered squires of Surrey and Hampshire hear of their grandfathers and their battles, or learn that lore of heraldry and chivalry which she handed down from a ruder but a more martial age? Poor as she was, there was no one in Surrey whose guidance would be more readily sought upon a question of precedence or of conduct than the Dame Ermyntrude Loring. She sat now with bowed back by the empty fireplace, and looked across at Nigel with all the harsh lines of her old ruddled face softening into love and pride. The young squire was busy cutting bird bolts for his crossbow and whistling softly as he worked. Suddenly he looked up and caught the dark eyes which were fixed upon him. He leaned forward and patted the bony hand. "What hath pleased you, dear dame? I read pleasure in your eyes. I have heard, Dame Nigel, how you came to win that great war-horse which stamps in our stable. Nay, dame, I had told you that the monks had given it to me."
"You said so, fair son, but never a word more. Yet the horse which you brought home was a different horse, I wot, to that which was given you. Why did you not tell me?"
"I should think it shame to talk of such a thing."
"So would your father before you, and his father no less. They would sit silent among the knights when the wine went round, and listen to every man's deeds. But if, perchance, there was anyone who spoke louder than the rest, and seemed to be eager for honour, then afterwards your father would pluck him softly by the sleeve, and whisper in his ear to learn if there was any small vow of which he could relieve him, or if he would deign to perform some noble deed of arms upon his person. And if the man were a braggart, and would go no further, your father would be silent, and none would know it. But if he bore himself well, your father would spread his fame far and wide, but never make mention of himself."
Nigel looked at the old woman with shining eyes. "I love to hear you speak of him," said he. "I pray you, tell me once more of the manner of his death."
"He died as he had lived, a very courtly gentleman. It was at the great sea battle on the Norman coast, and your father was in command of the afterguard in the king's own ship. Now the French had taken a great English ship the year before, when they had come over and held the narrow seas and burned the town of Southampton. This ship was the Christopher, and they placed it in the front of their battle, but the English closed upon it and stormed over its side, and slew all who were upon it.
but your father and Sir Loredan of Genoa, who commanded the Christopher, fought upon the high poop, so that all the fleet stopped to watch it. And the king himself cried aloud at the sight, for Sir Loredan was a famous man-at-arms and bore himself very stoutly that day. And many a knight envied your father that he should have chanced upon so excellent a person. But your father bore him back and struck him such a blow with a mace that he turned the helmet half round on his head, so that he could no longer see through the eye-holes. And Sir Loredan threw down his sword and gave himself to ransom. But your father took him by the helmet and twisted it until he had it straight upon his head. Then, when he could see once again, he handed him his sword and prayed him that he would rest himself and then continue, for it was great profit and joy to see any gentleman carry himself so well. So they sat together and rested by the rail of the poop, and even as they raised their hands again, your father was struck by a stone from a mangonel and so died. "And this Sir Loredan," cried Nigel, "he died also, I understand. I fear that he was slain by the archers, for they loved your father, and they do not see things with our eyes."
"It was a pity," said Nigel, "for it is clear that he was a good knight and bore himself very bravely.
Time was, when I was young, when commoners dared not have laid their grimy hands upon such a man. Men of gentle blood and coat-armour made war upon each other, and the others, spearmen or archers, could scramble amongst themselves. But now all are of a level, and only here and there are one like yourself, fair son, who reminds me of the men who are gone."
Nigel leaned forward and took her hands in his. "What I am, you have made me," said he.
"It is true, Nigel. I have indeed watched over you as the gardener watches his most precious blossom. For in you alone are all the hopes of our ancient house, and soon, very soon, you will be alone." "Nay, dear lady, say not that. I am very old, Nigel, and I feel the shadow closing in upon me. My heart yearns to go, for all whom I have known and loved have gone before me. And you, it will be a blessed day for you, since I have held you back from that world into which your brave spirit longs to plunge."
"Nay, nay, I have been happy here with you at Tilford."
"We are very poor, Nigel. I do not know where we may find the money to fit you for the wars. Yet we have good friends. There is Sir John Chandos, who has won such credit in the French wars, and who rides ever by the king's bridle arm. He was your father's friend, and they were squires together. If I sent you to court with a message to him, he would do what he could."
Nigel's face flushed. "Nay, Dame Ermyntrude, I must find my own gear, even as I have found my own horse, for I had rather ride into battle in this tunic than owe my suit to another."
I feared you would say so, Nigel, but indeed I know not how else we may get the money," said the old woman sadly. "It was different in the days of my father. I can remember that a suit of mail was but a small matter in those days, for in every English town such things could be made. But year by year, since men have come to take more care of their bodies, there have been added a plate of proof here and there, and a cunning joint, and all must be from Toledo or Milan, so that a knight must have much metal in his purse ere he puts any on his limbs." Nigel looked up wistfully at the old armour which was slung on the beams. "The ash spear is good," said he, "and so is the oaken shield with facings of steel. Sir Roger FitzAlan handled them, and said that he had never seen them better. But the armour..." Lady Ermyntrude shook her old head and laughed. "You have your father's great soul, Nigel, but you have not his mighty breadth of shoulder and length of limb. There was not in all the king's host a taller or stronger man. His harness would be little use to you. No, fair son, I rede you that when the time comes, you sell this crumbling house and the few acres which are still left, and go forth to the wars in the hope that with your own right hand you will plant the fortunes of a new house of Loring." A shadow of anger passed over Nigel's fresh young face. "I know not if we may hold off these monks and their lawyers much longer. This very day there came a man from Guildford with claims from the abbey extending back before my father's death." "Where are they, fair son?" "They are flapping on the furze bushes of Hankley, for I sent his papers and parchments downwind as fast as ever falcon flew."
"Nay, you are mad to do that, Nigel. And the man, where is he? Red Swire and old George the archer threw him in the Thursley bog. Alas! I fear me such things cannot be done in these days, though my father or my husband would have sent the rascal back to Guildford without his ears. But the church and the law are too strong now for us who are of gentler blood. Trouble will come of it, Nigel, for the Abbot of Waverley is not one who will hold back the shield of the church from those who are her servants. The Abbot would not hurt us. It is that lean grey wolf of a sacrist who hungers for our land. Let him do his worst. I fear him not. He has such an engine at his back, Nigel, that even the bravest must fear him. The ban which blasts a man's soul is in the keeping of his church, and what have we to place against it? I pray you to speak him fair, Nigel. Nay, dear lady, it is both my duty and my pleasure to do what you bid me, but I would die ere I ask as a favour that which we can claim as a right. Never can I cast my eyes from yonder window that I do not see the swelling downlands and the rich meadows, glade and dingle, copse and wood, which have been ours since Norman William gave them to that Loring who bore his shield at Senlac. Now, by trick and fraud, they have passed away from us, and many a franklin is a richer man than I. But never shall it be said that I saved the rest by bending my neck to their yoke. Let them do their worst, and let me endure it or fight it as best I may. The old lady sighed and shook her head. You speak as a Loring should, and yet I fear that some great trouble will befall us. But let us talk no more of such matters, since we cannot mend them. Where is your citole, Nigel? Will you not play and sing to me? The gentleman of those days could scarce read and write, but he spoke in two languages, played at least one musical instrument as a matter of course, and possessed a number of other accomplishments, from the imping of hawk's feathers to the mystery of venery, with knowledge of every beast and bird, its time of grace, and when it was seasonable. As far as physical feats went, to vault barebacked upon a horse, to hit a running hare with a crossbow bolt, or to climb the angle of a castle courtyard, were feats which had come by nature to the young squire. But it was very different with music, which had called for many a weary hour of irksome work. Now, at last, he could master the strings, but both his ear and his voice were not of the best, so that it was well, perhaps, that there was so small and so unprejudiced an audience to the Norman French chanson, which he sang in a high, reedy voice, with great earnestness of feeling, but with many a slip and quaver, waving his yellow head in cadence to the music. A sword, a sword, ah, give me a sword, for the world is all to win. Though the way be hard and the door be barred, the strong man enters in. If chance and fate still hold the gate, give me the iron key, and turret high my plume shall fly, or you may weep for me. A horse, ah, give me a horse, to bear me out afar, where blackest need and grimmest deed and sweetest perils are. Hold thou my ways from glutted days, where poisoned leisure lies, and point the path of tears and wrath, which mounts to high emprise. A heart, a heart, ah, give me a heart, to rise to circumstance, serene and high, and bold to try the hazard of the chance, with strength to wait, but fixed as fate, to plan and dare and do, the peer of all and only thrall, sweet lady mine, to you. It may have been that the sentiment went for more than the music, or it may have been that the nicety of her own ears had been dulled by age, but old Dame Ermyntrude clapped her lean hands together and cried out in shrill applause. "Weathercote has indeed an apt pupil," she said. "I pray you that you will sing again." "Nay, dear dame, it is turn and turn betwixt you and me. I beg that you will recite a romance, you who know them all. For all the years that I have listened, I have never yet come to the end of them, and I dare swear that there are more in your head than in all the great books which they showed me at Guildford Castle. I would fain hear Doon of Mayence, or the Song of Roland, or Sir Isumbras." So the old dame broke into a long poem, slow and dull in the inception, but quickening as the interest grew, until with darting hands and glowing face she poured forth the verses which told of the emptiness of sordid life, the beauty of heroic death, and the high sacredness of love and the bondage of honour. Nigel, with set, still features and brooding eyes, drank in the fiery words, until at last they died upon the old woman's lips, and she sank back weary in her chair. Nigel stooped over her and kissed her brow. "Your words will ever be as a star upon my path," said he. Then, carrying over the small table and the chessmen, he proposed that they should play their usual game before they sought their rooms for the night. But a sudden and rude interruption broke in upon their gentle contest. A dog pricked its ears and barked. The others ran growling to the door. And then there came a sharp clash of arms, a dull, heavy blow as from a club or sword pommel, and a deep voice from without summoned them to open in the king's name. The old dame and Nigel had both sprung to their feet, their table overturned and their chessmen scattered among the rushes. Nigel's hand had sought his crossbow, but the Lady Ermyntrude grasped his arm. "Nay, fair son, have you not heard that it is in the king's name?" said she. "Down, Talbot! Down, Bayard! Open the door and let his messenger in." Nigel undid the bolt, and the heavy wooden door swung outwards upon its hinges. The light from the flaring cressets beat upon steel caps and fierce bearded faces, with the glimmer of drawn swords and the yellow gleam of bowstaves. A dozen armed archers forced their way into the room. At their head were the gaunt sacrist of Waverley, and a stout, elderly man, clad in a red velvet doublet and breeches much stained and mottled with mud and clay. He bore a great sheet of parchment with a fringe of dangling seals, which he held aloft as he entered. "I call on Nigel Loring," he cried. "I, the officer of the King's Law, and the lay summoner of Waverley, call upon the man named Nigel Loring."
"I am he."
"Yes, it is he," cried the sacrist. "Archers, do as you were ordered." In an instant the band threw themselves upon him like the hounds on a stag. Desperately Nigel strove to gain his sword, which lay upon the iron coffer. With the convulsive strength which comes from the spirit rather than from the body, he bore them all in that direction, but the sacrist snatched the weapon from its place, and the rest dragged the writhing squire to the ground and swathed him in a cord. "Hold him fast, good archers. Keep a stout grip on him," cried the summoner. "I pray you, one of you, prick off those great dogs which snarl at my heels. Stand off, I say, in the name of the king. Watkin, come betwixt me and these creatures who have as little regard for the law as their master." One of the archers kicked off the faithful dogs, but there were others of the household who were equally ready to show their teeth in defence of the old house of Loring. From the door which led to their quarters there emerged the pitiful muster of Nigel's threadbare retainers. There was a time when 10 knights, 40 men-at-arms, and 200 archers would march behind the Scarlet Roses. Now, at this last rally, when the young head of the house lay bound in his own hall, there mustered at his call the page Charles with a cudgel, John the cook with his longest spit, Red Squire, the aged man-at-arms, with a formidable axe swung over his snowy head, and Weathercote, the minstrel, with a boar spear. Yet this motley array was fired with the spirit of the house, and under the lead of the fierce old soldier they would certainly have flung themselves upon the ready swords of the archers had the Lady Ermyntrude not swept between them. "Stand back, squire!" she cried. "Back, Weathercote! Charles, put a leash on Talbot and hold Bayard back!" Her black eyes blazed upon the invaders until they shrank from the baleful gaze. "Who are you, you rascal robbers, who dare to misuse the king's name and to lay hands upon one whose smallest drop of blood has more worth than all your thrall and caitiff bodies?" "Not so fast, dame, not so fast, I pray you," cried the stout summoner, whose face had resumed its natural colour, now that he had a woman to deal with. "There is a law of England, mark you, and there are those who serve and uphold it, who are true men and the king's own lieges. Such a one am I. Then again, there are those who take such as me and transfer, carry, or convey us into a bog or morass. Such a one is this graceless old man with the axe, whom I have seen already this day. There are also those who tear, destroy, or scatter the papers of the law, of which this young man is the chief. Therefore I would read you, dame, not to rail against us, but to understand that we are the king's men, on the king's own service. What then is your errand in this house at this hour of night?" The summoner cleared his throat pompously, and turning his parchment to the light of the cressets, he read out a long document in Norman French, couched in such a style
and such a language that the most involved and foolish of our forms were simplicity itself compared to those by which the men of the long gown made a mystery of that of which all things on earth should be the plainest and the most simple. Despair fell cold upon Nigel's heart and blanched the face of the old dame as they listened to the dread catalogue of claims and suits and issues, questions of peccary and turbary, of houseboat and fireboat, which ended by a demand for all the lands, hereditaments, tenements, messuages and curtilages, which made up their worldly all. Nigel, still bound, had been placed with his back against the iron coffer, whence he heard with dry lips and moist brow this doom of his house. Now he broke in on the recital with a vehemence which made the summoner jump. "You shall rue what you have done this night," he cried. "Poor as we are, we have our friends who will not see us wronged, and I will plead my cause before the King's own Majesty at Windsor, that he who saw the father die may know what things are done in his royal name against the son. But these matters are to be settled in course of law in the King's courts, and how will you excuse yourself for this assault upon my house and person?" "Nay, that is another matter," said the sacrist. "The question of debt may indeed be an affair of a civil court, but it is a crime against the law and an act of the devil which comes within the jurisdiction of the Abbey Court of Waverley when you dare to lay hands upon the summoner or his papers." "Indeed, he speaks the truth," cried the official. "I know no blacker sin." "Therefore," said the stern monk, "it is the order of the Holy Father Abbot that you sleep this night in the Abbey cell, and that tomorrow you be brought before him in the court, held in the chapter house, so that you receive the fit punishment for this and the many other violent and forward deeds which you have wrought upon the servants of the Holy Church." "Enough is now said, worthy Master Summoner. Archers, remove your prisoner." As Nigel was lifted up by four stout archers, the Dame Ermyntrude would have rushed to his aid, but the sacrist thrust her back. "Stand off, proud woman. Let the law take its course, and learn to humble your heart before the power of Holy Church. Has your life not taught its lesson? You, whose horn was exalted amongst the highest, and will soon not have a roof above your grey hairs. Stand back, I say, lest I lay a curse upon you." The old dame flamed suddenly into white wrath as she stood before the angry monk. "Listen to me while I lay a curse upon you and yours," she cried as she raised her shriveled arms and blighted him with her flashing eyes. "As you have done to the House of Loring, so may God do to you until your power is swept from the land of England, and of your great Abbey of Waverley there is nothing left but a pile of grey stones in a green meadow. I see it, with my old eyes I see it. From scullion to abbot and from cellar to tower, may Waverley and all within it droop and wither from this night on." The monk, hard as he was, quailed before this frantic figure and the bitter burning words. Already the summoner and the archers with their prisoner were clear of the house. He turned, and with a clang he shut the heavy door behind him. End of chapter 4.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.